Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project Explainer Podcast, part of RTP's Fourth Branch podcast series. My name is Jack Derwin and I'm Assistant Director of RTP. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Daniel Greenberg and Anastasia Bowden to discuss occupational regulation in the beauty industry. Dan Greenberg is president of the Advance Arkansas Institute, a think tank committed to advancing public policy based on free markets, individual liberty, and limited government. Previously, Dan served in the Arkansas House of Representatives from 2006 to 2011. Anastasia Bowden, our host today, is an attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation's Economic Liberty Project, where much of her work involves challenging laws and regulations that threaten competition and free speech. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks, Jack. It's wonderful to be here to talk about two of my very favorite things, glamour and the beautiful, precious constitutional right of individuals to earn a living in the profession of their choice. And of course, one of the biggest threats to people's ability to earn a living right now is occupational licensure. Licenses are hard to get, they're expensive, they require a ton of training. And so I thought we'd start out, Dan, by asking you very generally, why are professions licensed?
Well, I guess there are really two reasons that come to mind, and I'm reminded of something that our host just brought up a few seconds ago. About 15 years ago, back when I was a state legislator, I got a phone call from someone who had a very important issue to discuss with me. He went into great detail about the menace of unregulated and unlicensed burglar alarm installers. And he was extremely well informed on this topic. And he went into great detail explaining to me the immense dangers of what might happen if you have these fly-by-night burglar alarm installers, the dangers to consumers, the dangers to public safety, and so on and so forth. And I said, well, you seem very interested in this, and you seem to know a lot about it. Have you had experience with unlicensed burglar alarm installers? He said, No. I'm a certified burglar alarm installer. I'm just very concerned about the dangers to the public welfare of these other people. And I said, I see, because what that illustrated to me again was these two reasons that people want to see licensing. One of the reasons is often explained in terms of public safety, public interest, consumer welfare. And sometimes we suspect that there's a second class of reasons. And that second class of reasons is sort of summed up by economic self-interest and lobbying of special interest groups of policymakers so as to reduce or in some respects eliminate competition. And so what I think we see is sometimes we see that there are public reasons for occupational licensing, and there are sort of private and self-interested and relatively malign reasons for occupational licensing.
It seems to me that first justification that you talk about, which is legitimate, public health and safety, is undermined by the explosion in occupational licensure recently, where licensure has been extended not just to doctors and lawyers and things that we traditionally think of, but as you brought up, you know, burglar alarm installers, or in Louisiana, there's floristry, or there was a proposed law to regulate dog walkers in New York City. And here in California, we have upholsters and so on and so forth. And I think some people have some skepticism when it comes to beauty professions as well. What's the rationale when it comes to licensing beauty professions like barbers, manicurists, and cosmetologists?
Well, there's a whole galaxy of reasons that people give for these things, but let me just focus on a few of them. I mean, the first is, you know, consumer protection of safety and health, and there are other reasons having to do with making sure that the professional, like, you know, the cosmetologist or the barber, is sufficiently skilled in terms of creating and transmitting beauty onto his or her client. There are reasons having to do with certification that we, you know, the idea is that we want to protect these shops from hiring people with insufficient credentials. And so I think some of these reasons are stronger than others. And in particular, I think it helps to sort of take these reasons or justifications one by one. Can we talk just a little bit about public safety and protection of the consumer and health and so forth with respect to cosmetologists and barbers?
Well, let's hear it, because, you know, I started out my day by practicing unlicensed cosmetology and blow drying my own hair. So tell me about why that's dangerous to the public.
So, I mean, I think it's fair to say that it's definitely in the public interest to make sure that cosmetologists and barbers know how to sharpen and sterilize and wield their tools. But if you look at barber and cosmetology training, I think you're going to see in the statutes, which is, and this is set out with respect to what barber schools and cosmetology schools have to teach. I think you're going to see in these statutes and regulations that a great deal of the training that these professionals have to receive by law is completely unrelated to health and safety reasons. On the contrary, a lot of it seems devoted to matters like learning the history of various hairstyles. And I mean, I think it's fine for professionals to learn more about makeup and color theory and the beautification of fingernails. But the health and safety portions of this type of training is often pretty minor. And so when we talk about public safety and public interest, I think it's helpful to separate the training that's genuinely focused on the health and safety of the client from the training that's focused more in the beautification of the client. And so there are certain types of education, right, or certain areas of the curriculum that are more focused on health and safety than others.
Yeah, and you really dug into this in your recent paper, and I believe you studied 38 jurisdictions with regards to barbers, cosmetologists, and manicurists. And what exactly did you find specifically when it came to the training that's required for prospective beauty professionals?
So what I found was there are 38 jurisdictions where I thought that you could really measure the health and safety requirements in the cosmetology and barber curriculum. And with respect to those 38 jurisdictions, I found that somewhere between 25 and 26% of the training that these prospective professionals have to take is devoted to health and safety. On average, barbers have to undergo about 1,350 hours of training. On average, cosmetologists have to undergo just under 1,500 hours of training. Those are national figures. And in each case, the percentage of health and safety training is between 25 and 26%. And there's a lot of training that I think really has nothing to do with health and safety that's required in some states. In South Carolina, cosmetologists have to take 50 hours of training in public relations and salesmanship and psychology. In my home state of Arkansas, cosmetologists have to endure 50 hours of training in courtesy and neatness and professional attitude. Oklahoma has a 175-hour requirement for barber training in salesmanship, job search, shop management, history of barbering, and professional image. And so the relationship of this type of training to health and safety or consumer welfare is pretty mysterious.
Yeah. So I guess what you're saying is, to the extent that there is a real health and safety threat to unlicensed cosmetology, you know, I was joking about blow drying my hair earlier, but certainly when you're dyeing people's hairs with chemicals and whatnot, there could be a concern. Licensure isn't actually related to that interest. And I think it is pretty shocking when you talk about all the sort of surprising things that prospective beauty professionals have to learn. But might that provide any other benefits? Does the state contend that this results in better hairdos or better courtesy? And is that legitimate?
Well, so here we get into sort of the fraught question of, this is sort of a large philosophical question of whether there are absolute standards of beauty that cosmetologists need to learn and to be trained in and to be proficient in, or whether alternatively there's no accounting for tastes, as the old saying goes, and that we don't really need to worry about a professional or government mark of quality with respect to training in these crafts, because as the old joke goes, you know, what's the difference between a good haircut and a bad haircut? The answer is 2 weeks. It's often the case that if you get, to be blunt, what you think of as an ugly haircut or an ugly procedure. There are really no health benefits or deficits that are involved at all. And presumably, if you run into a bad practitioner, a low quality practitioner, there are better ways to solve this problem than to have everyone be licensed in these non-health and safety areas. And more precisely, I take it many of us have had the experience of trying to figure out where to get a good haircut in a city or town that you've just moved to. The way you answer these questions is word of mouth, and often word of mouth eliminates low quality practitioners in a number of fields and directs consumers to relatively skilled practitioners.
Yeah, and of course that's been spurred on by the creation of online websites like Yelp and whatnot, where it's relatively easy to access information like that. But I also found it interesting in your article, you point out that we don't traditionally think of bad haircuts as a harm.
Right.
Because you can't, for example, walk into court. I've seen a lot of frivolous lawsuits in my life, but I've certainly never seen somebody walk into court and try to sue somebody else because they were dissatisfied with the way that they look after a bad haircut. So.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I want to be clear about this because, I mean, I think it's worth underscoring, right, that not all the training has to do with aesthetic qualities. Not all the training has to do with beauty. I think that the health and safety aspects of learning how to, give a proficient haircut are fairly minor. I think that the health and safety aspects that people need to be trained in with respect to curling or uncurling hair, with respect to chemical treatments, are relatively major. If you actually study cosmetology, you will find that if you apply certain types of hair relaxation chemicals in a negligent way, then the hair will begin to smoke or even melt. And so it's really crucial, right, that you're trained in some health and safety aspects. It's really crucial that you know what to do when you're working with chemicals and hot wax. It's crucial that you understand procedures of sterilization. But again, what I think needs to be underscored is that this type of training, as far as I can tell, is a relatively small percentage of the beauty curriculum, of the barber curriculum. I guess I would also, there's one thing that occurs to me that I suppose I ought to add, which is that in addition to my discovery that 25 or 26% nationally of the barber and cosmetology curriculum is devoted to health and safety, the percentage for manicurists or nail technicians is much larger. It's around 40%. And I think it's fair to say that if you're really concerned about health problems and health-related training, you really need to focus on or think about sterilization and dangers that come from lack of sterilization and related safety issues in nail salons. I think that's why there's a much larger percentage of health and safety training for manicurists. That is actually a real problem because you can, if you don't run your nail salon right, I mean, you can transmit infections. So again, I guess I just want to underscore that the chief concern here is not so much that it's all focused on beauty. My chief concern is that a lot of it is focused on beauty. And I think that there's a weak or non-existent justification for licensing people to get trained in beauty crafts or beauty technology or whatever you would call it.
Yeah, I understand that. I think that's really interesting because, in my line of work, that sort of conclusion that there's a mismatch between legitimate health and safety ends and the actual licensure requirements, that opens up some of these laws to constitutional lawsuits. And we've seen in other states, hair braiders bring lawsuits saying that the cosmetology requirements don't actually teach hair braiding. And so, even where we accept that there's a legitimate health and safety end, it's really important to point out that really broad mismatch where it exists and its correlation where it exists.
Yes. And of course, there are really all sorts of mismatches in the particular sector of training that we're talking about here. There was a really fascinating article in the New York Times about 2 years ago about the practices in, I believe, Iowa. And, you know, one of the practices in cosmetology schools is that you offer free or cut rate services that are performed by cosmetology students. And that's part of the education and training that cosmetology students undergo. And so the way that it works is the cosmetology students come in and they wait around for customers to come in so that they can, you know, style their hair or do their nails or whatever. And if nobody comes in, if the customers don't come in, then it's just, you know, if you see nobody over the course of an 8-hour day, it's counted as 8 hours of training. It's counted as training whether customers show up or not. And so that strikes me as having essentially zero value for education or in safety or education and beautification. And the estimate that one of the students gave of the time that they spent in training, which is to say, waiting for people to come around who didn't. The estimate that one of the students gave was 50%. So if they for instance had 100 hours of required training and they're only working 50% of the time, they still get their full hours credit. So they spend a lot of time just to fill up their hours. They spend a lot of time just waiting around for customers to come in. Customers don't come in, and so it's a system, I think, that measures number of hours consumed, but really doesn't measure learning anything, doesn't measure having any consequences in any strong way.
Now, when I go into court to challenge occupational licensing laws, the burden is on the plaintiff to negate every conceivable justification. So I think it's important maybe to comment on some of the other justifications we'll see, because they don't just say health and safety. Sometimes they say the other things that we've talked about, even when they're weak. Yeah. What about also the contention that the employers themselves like licensure because it allows them to, you know, sort of be able to tell who to hire? And also some of the professionals themselves justify these laws on the basis that it inflates their wages. What do you make of the legitimacy of these justifications?
Right. So, you know, you would know better than I do about the constitutional standing of these types of justifications. But I guess I would say that with respect to the justification of licensing, that it raises professionals' wages through scarcity, or that it makes salon owners' jobs easier because it serves as a kind of quasi-certification so they know who to hire. It seems to me that this is really kind of not a benefit to the public. It seems to me that this is really something like a subsidy to a private interest, either the salon owner or the professionals themselves. And so I see a private interest justification. I see that there might be certain members of the population who would like it, but I don't think it's a public interest justification at all. It doesn't seem to help the public at all. It only helps a small number of people who are, of course, members of the public. But you would have to, I think I would have to ask you as to whether a private justification is on the same constitutional ground as a public justification, whether those two types of arguments are of the same strength, or I would hope that they wouldn't be.
Yeah, well, I'm with you on that, Dan, that I hope and believe that they are not on the same footing. But what's really interesting about that is, unbelievably, in some circuits, that is some appellate jurisdictions, those circuit courts have held that burdening some people's right to earn a living in order to protect others from competition is a perfectly legitimate government interest. And that's just politics, and that's perfectly acceptable. And I would argue, no, that's irrational. That violates due process, that when you restrict people's liberty, you have to be providing a benefit generally. But that is a circuit split that is very ripe for the Supreme Court to comment on. And it's part of what we do in my litigation. So it's a good question to ask, because I think it's very important and something that the Supreme Court eventually needs to resolve.
Yeah. You know, if I'm remembering correctly, there was some rhetoric in some of these coffin manufacturer cases where, you know, the coffin manufacturers were arguing that they ought to have a privilege. And in some circuits, this was explained by the courts as saying, well, essentially, if you give certain special interests a privilege, well, this kind of lobbying and political behavior is as American as apple pie, to essentially give people a privilege that other people don't have. Well, I guess it's as American as apple pie, in the same sense that, I don't know, armed robbery is as American as apple pie, and that, you know, it happens a lot in America. But it's, I think it is hard to justify essentially unequal treatment and, you know, giving some people through government something like a property right that other people just don't have. It's just, it seems to me that that's very difficult to make a straight-faced constitutional argument for.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why research like yours is so important. And I wish I was surprised when I read it, but I'm not, because you do see things like laws that say that you can only sell coffins if you're licensed with all of these requirements. And, you know, the requirements have nothing to do with just simply selling a coffin, or in Louisiana, where you're not even required to be buried in a coffin at all. Or, you know, these teeth whitening cases where only dentists can do this simple teeth whitening. This is a common thing that we see in our work. But, you know, with regards to your paper, some of it is academic, and that's well and good. But I think for most people, it would be interesting to talk about the real world effects. What is this? What are the real world effects of this mismatch and the onerous licensing requirements on the practitioners themselves? What's gonna be the result?
So, in my view, when we look at what happens in cosmetology education today, it creates a kind of raw injustice. It creates a set of terrible results. You have people who are taking out significant loans to spend an hour, excuse me, significant loans to spend 1,500 hours on average of cosmetology education to get a job that, on average, you know, pays something like $27,000, $28,000 a year. That's the average wage for cosmetologists, or at least it was about 1 or 2 years ago. And that extra year of foregone income, combined with the kind of debt burden that people are taking, resulting in compensation that's not especially high. When you look at the national picture, it seems to me that there's a kind of waste of resources and a sort of a set of inefficiencies, part of which, you know, taxpayers bear through these loan systems and loan guarantees. It seems to me that we're really offering cosmetology students not such a great deal, and I am somewhat skeptical that the system right now really serves even their interests. And what I would like to see is people sort of learning from the experience and learning from the structure that my paper lays out. I'd like to see policymakers looking at this and saying, hey, you know, even assuming that we want to protect health and safety, if we look at the health and safety classes and schemes and structures that are currently set up, it seems like we could cut the required education by something like 75%, and we wouldn't suffer any drop at all in health and safety education. We'd have essentially no health and safety consequences, even if we assume that all this health and safety education actually results in improved health and safety. If we could substantially reduce the number of hours that was required in order to get these licenses, it seems to me that it would have great, strong economic consequences and reduce the foregone income and help people get a job without placing all these unwarranted and unnecessary burdens on them.
Well, the good news, Dan, is that occupational licensure is kind of a hot topic in the policy world. I mean, I use that term loosely, hot topic. It's a hot topic in our geeky policy world.
Oh, no, sad but true. Yes.
No offense, because I'm one of these geeks. But yeah. It's a bipartisan topic too. And so I'm wondering if that sort of widespread support has manifested itself in any changes in state law.
Well, over the last couple of years, Texas and Vermont have reduced their training hours that are required for cosmetologists from 1,500 to 1,000. That makes those two states, Texas and Vermont, some of the least burdensome licensing requiring states in the nation. Vermont up the ante by creating the nation's least burdensome training requirements for barbers, 750 hours. Florida now requires people who are trained as barbers only to be trained in sanitation, safety, and state law. Although this I found interesting. I may be one of the only one of the very few people in the world who finds this stuff interesting. But it seems to me that if you actually look at the Florida regulations, they are not quite so strict with respect to following this law, because they seem to cover things having to do with matters far outside of the orbit of sanitation, safety, and state law, even though the law does not permit them to do so. But as a general matter, I do think that state policymakers are beginning to cut away at some of these things, but there is much more work to be done.
Well, unless you have anything to add, I just want to thank everyone for giving me an opportunity or an excuse to dress up and blow dry my hair for the theme of glamour and economic liberty and to do this podcast today. But Dan, unless you have anything else to add, I think we've covered a lot.
I am very grateful to the Federalist Society for the wonderful service it does in helping to educate people about the very important issues of licensing overreach and economic liberty.
Well, thank you both so much for joining the podcast today to discuss such an important topic. And thank you to our audience for tuning into this episode of RTP's Explainer Podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on any major podcast platform and check out our website, regproject.org, or social media accounts at FedSuckRTP to learn more. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.